Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Our weekly check-in right now with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. Here is Cheryl Sharp this morning. Hey, Cheryl, how's it going?
Good morning. How are you?
Doing fine, thank you. So I heard that the commission is pairing up with a group that's called Desegregate Connecticut. First of all, if anyone hasn't heard of them, what is this group all about and why are you guys now working together?
We just started our partnership with them a week and a half ago. And it's important because we have some cases that deal with the zoning laws that tend to create segregation. As you know, some of Connecticut cities are the most segregated in the country. And zoning laws contribute to that segregation by having rules in place that require you to have a lot of money to move into certain areas because there are restrictions on one-family homes, that you can only have a one-family home in a certain area, or that you have to have so much land to build a house on 1 acre or 2 acres of land. And those things, of course, prohibit low-income people from moving in and also have a disparate effect on Black and brown people in terms of them moving into suburban towns that surround cities.
So what is the goal that your partnership is looking to tackle?
We're looking to tackle some of these zoning laws and regulations because it's at a local level. It's the towns that are enforcing their zoning laws and making their zoning laws. And it is really reminiscent of when we had restrictive covenants where it would be very clear that a Black person can't buy this piece of property. I think it was in 1916 that the U.S. Supreme Court said that having those types of rules in place where we're keeping people segregated for peace, that's what it used to be. It's to maintain racial balance and peace and keep Black people separate from white people. We're going to have Black people live in one area and white people live in another area, or Black people live in one block and white people live in a different block. That is no longer acceptable. It wasn't acceptable then. It was outlawed in 1916 with the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and it shouldn't continue. Our Connecticut laws prohibit discrimination in housing, and so this is just another opportunity for our agency to work with a group that is looking at and trying to dismantle some of the ills that we have in our society and here, right here in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. Talking right now with Cheryl Sharp, who's with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities. So how long would you say Connecticut has really struggled with a lack of available housing?
Oh, for decades.
Yeah, easily.
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, we have a lot of old housing stock in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And so then we have some housing stock that is has lead paint issues. Then we have in the suburban towns, the housing stock that is there is so expensive that it precludes a lot of low income families. There's some resistance because by offering housing stock to different people, it may change the dynamics of the community, only in that now there would be more Black and brown people in some of the suburban communities. And so you have some pushback related to that, which is really unfortunate because diversity certainly enhances any area, whether it's in the workplace or where you live, you know, that diversity of thought and that diversity of culture is so important, and it actually enriches areas. But we have to so much to learn about one another that it makes it difficult to happen. So talking with Sarah Bronin, who is one of the organizers for Desegregate Connecticut, we got really excited about what their intentions are to address these, you know, zoning laws. And like I said, our agency has some zoning cases that are pending right now where we're attempting to deal with some of these issues that affect, you know, a number of class bases. Some of the zoning laws make it so that it's difficult for some families with children to live in a certain town, or difficult for individuals who have non-traditional families, because the law will say that those living in the home have to be blood related, and if they're not, then they can't, only so many people can live in the home.
Sure.
So then it really affects non-traditional families as well.
Wow.
And it's an important issue, one that, you know, we're having a place to live, a safe place to be, having the opportunity to live where you want to live is really important to your quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a commission that is empowered to enforce anti-discrimination laws, this is a critical time in our history that we act now. And what better partner than someone who is an expert in zoning and has had years of working on this issue as a professor. So we're excited about working with Sarah Bronin on this.
Yeah. And my question for you, Cheryl, is there a website, maybe your website, where people can learn a little bit more about this and really get an idea of how severe of an issue it is here in Connecticut?
Yes. We have to put the link up. We just went live with a new website on Friday.
Oh, cool. So, congrats.
We're still, thank you. We're still working on getting things up on that website. But anyone can go to Desegregate Connecticut. So, and that website tells all about their movement and what they're trying to do. And then by the end of this week, anyone can go to our website, which is ct.gov/CHRO, and we will have a link to that website as well. The public can see the devastation really that's caused by people not having a safe place to live or
sure.
having housing options and opportunities. Communities really should be open, and that's what we're trying to make sure happens. And in that openness, there should be no discrimination, that people should have an opportunity, irrespective of whether they are Black or brown, irrespective of whether they have children or not. They should have a safe place to go to school, a safe place to live.
Sure.
So our cities need to be safe, and our suburban towns need to be safe for anyone who wants an opportunity to live in them.
Cheryl, we appreciate your insight this morning. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again next week.
Okay, great. Thank you. Take care.
It is 8:40 right now, and hoping to check in this morning with Sam Pleasant, who is a local activist, has been, you know, involved in a lot of the local events that have been going on, some of the protests that have gone on, and Sam is here now. Sam, thank you so much for being here this morning. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here. So I know I connected with Kira, who I've had on the air a couple of times ahead of the Bridgeport camp out. But tell me kind of what your role has been in these last couple of months.
So honestly, you know, I'm a senior at the University of Connecticut. I go to the Stanford campus. I grew up in Darien, which is a town like right over from Stanford.
Yep.
You know, I've been very privileged my entire life growing up in Darien, Connecticut, but I'm very aware of, you know, what's going on around me. And I just felt I would be remiss not to get involved and, you know, kind of lay my privilege down. I went to a protest, I think about, you know, right when like the George Floyd protests started popping up.
Sure.
In Stanford, and I heard Stephen Barrier's brother speak, and I never even heard about Stephen Barrier's case. He was killed by Stanford police on October 23rd, 2019. It was actually his 23rd birthday, which is, you know, it's just crazy in itself. But, you know, I felt kind of bad and just in my privilege just showed, because I was like, wow, I've never heard of this case. It happened a town over from me. You know, and I felt compelled to speak out. So me and my sister kind of just started doing our own research. We started posting things on the internet to make people aware. We even went by ourselves with posters standing in front of the police department, just, you know, with his name on it, a picture of him, some of the quotes from like the tapes that were released from his arrest. So we we saw what was going on in Bridgeport. I actually went there one night. I connected with Kira through Justice for a Movie, mm-hmm. because she's very involved in that. And she told me about the Bridgeport encampment. So I went there, and it was just, it's awesome. I mean, the idea of what community can be like, you get that feeling when you're there. And I was talking to a bunch of people at the Stanford camp yesterday, and I was saying how, like, you know, we're all coming from different walks of life. We all have different jobs. But when we come to this camp, we're all the same. You know what I mean? It's like we're all working together. Everyone has their own job. We have community meetings. Like, that's how life should be. And it's just nice, too, because even, like, you know, there's like, homeless people around the park, and we give them food. They have masks. They have Purell. We make sure they have water. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's nice to see how everybody coming together as one.
Sure. Now, is the camp still going on? Is that still outside in Stanford
yes.
right now? It is.
It is. I have lupus, so I had to leave yesterday because I was just getting, like, heat exhaustion. Mm-hmm. But I'm going back down there today. You know, I just sometimes, you know, you need a break, like, a little bit. It's just been very hot the past couple of days.
Yes, it has.
And it's good because, you know, there's four organizers that really, like, you know, put this together. That's mm-hmm. me, my sister, and then my two friends. I'm not going to share their name because I'm not sure if they're really comfortable with me doing that right now.
Sure.
We're just making sure we're all on top of everything. It's very peaceful. I know there's some people that might come by and like agitators, but we make sure that, like, what we're doing is, like, we want to educate people. And if they don't want to listen, we turn our backs to them.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, we try to be like, there's no, we don't want any, like, confrontation.
We
want everything to go smoothly.
Now, Sam, what are you guys calling for? I know that, you know, the Stanford police in the very beginning, that was one of the images that actually went nationwide, where you saw the chief kneeling with protesters in solidarity. And while that's been applauded, you guys are still calling for some changes from the Stanford Police Department specifically. What are you asking for?
So our number one demand is defund the Stanford Police.
What do you mean by that?
I feel like a lot of people get, like, scared when people say that. We want to just take their what is invested into Stanford Police Department and cut that budget by 50%, because it's absolutely ridiculous. They took away $15 million from the education budget. I know a lot of people that work in the education system in Stanford, and jobs are being cut, pay's being cut, which is just, it's unnecessary. So for our number one demand, we want to use our community funding to create resources and opportunities for people in the community who are underserved. We also would like to invest the money into education as a whole and into our education professionals. Our number two demand is police policy change. So even though Stanford is denying that they are a part of the 1033 program, I have proof that they are. We want them to immediately withdraw from that program. And we want the complete demilitarization of the Stanford Police Department, along with removal of the utility truck and combat assault vehicle, tactical vehicle that they have. We also want police officers to have policy to exhaust all alternatives before shooting. We immediately want to terminate the gang database and the broken window policy and eliminate monthly quotas. We just think that they're unnecessary, and it just criminalizes people that don't need to be criminalized. Number three, we want to make internal police investigations public. This is Stephen Barrier's mom. This is kind of like her demand, too, because a lot was redacted from, like, the original videos and, like, the original 911 call. So we want to publicize all the officers and the EMT names that were involved in the death of Stephen Barrier and arrest them. We demand a release of the full police report to the public and a release of the initial 911 call that was redacted. We also want to place a policy that will require any internal police investigations to be made to the public, because they are serving the public. So we should be able to see, like, you know, what's going on behind closed doors. And we also want any complaints made about officers permanently on their record. The last one is very important. It's mental health care reform. Mm-hmm. If you've noticed with the cases that have gone on in Connecticut, a lot of them were mental health crises, and they didn't need police officers to come and brutalize them. Personally, I have my own mental health issues that I deal with, and I know that if I were having a crisis, I would not respond lightly to a bunch of police officers screaming in my face.
Sure.
You know
absolutely.
I mean?
Just, sure.
we need kindness. We need understanding. So for that one, we want to call an investigation into Sanford's South 1 psychiatric unit, and we want to follow through with testimonies made from individuals. For the past couple of weeks, we've been talking to people that have been in that psychiatric unit, and just hearing their stories of how they've been treated is just horrific. So we're not even just saying it's just the police. This is a problem with our system. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's just, we need to...
It goes beyond the department.
Yeah. And it's just, we need to start working together. We're not coming for anybody. We want to do this to help everyone. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to, like, we're not evil. It's like, we're trying to make it so everyone can live in a world that's fair.
We have a better world.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Sam, I would love to have you back on again if you would like to. I know, you know, with the Bridgeport campout, Kira tried to come back on, but things got a little chaotic, I know, with everything. But, you know, a great result out of Bridgeport where they, you know, they saw changes a week later. So I would love to have you back on, you know, when things start to wrap up, if you'd be comfortable. I'd love to have you back on.
Of course. Yeah. Okay. I want to be a lawyer, and I also want to run for public office. So me, like, I'm born to be, like, to speak. I want to speak out, and I'm definitely around for all of that. So, you know, you have my contact info. You let me know.
Excellent. Well, Sam, I look forward to talking to you again and having you on the show very soon. Thank you for all you're doing.
Great. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Lieutenant Perez, good to have you. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. So earlier in my news reports, I was talking about Westport Police. They said that as we're starting to ease up on some of the pandemic standards, if you will, property crime seems to be going up. They're seeing a lot of issues with stolen vehicles and shoplifting. Mm-hmm. Now, is Fairfield seeing similar trends?
Yeah, we are. And, you know, there's two things that are going on, really. So it's kind of like almost like a little perfect storm that's going on. The first one is every summer, generally, we get an uptick in property crimes. And that's because people have, you know, more access to walk around and that kind of stuff. The second thing is exactly what you said, the COVID. As we enter into different phases and things get less restrictive, there's going to be more movement. We have always had an issue in this entire region with vehicles being stolen, particularly by youths. So you're talking like 13-year-olds to 17-year-olds who know that they can't really get in much trouble. So they go, they come from all these different cities and all these different areas, and they literally rampage through neighborhoods. That's the only way I can put it. And they're stealing cars. And it's only a matter of time before someone gets seriously injured and hurt. But more importantly, that trend is on an uptick. There's also an uptick in shoplifting. So as people seem to feel more freer, they're going into large box stores and even smaller stores and of course, committing larcenies. And, you know, part of the problem with that is that there's some places that just will not prosecute. So, you know, I'm not going to name them, but they're out there. They just want warnings. But, you know, we're out there doing what we can, as every police officer is all the time. The third thing that's going on, which creates the perfect storm, is we also have this animosity towards police, or this kind of like, I don't even know the word. But here's the deal. I have talked to officers who say they feel increasingly uncomfortable because sometimes when they're going out there, and, you know, and it could be our own little stigma thing, but, you know, our own little thing in our head. But sometimes when they're dealing with the public, and I know that the overwhelming amount of public support us, but there are those few that kind of make the kind of spoil it. And they give you that, you know, that kind of like suspicious look, or they question you, or, you know, I've had officers confronted where, you know, where people are saying, you know, why do you have to do that? You know, like everything's being questioned.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of like in a sort of like a Twilight Zone type of, atmosphere right now. And so, but I can tell you this, police officers, you know, we're sort of used to it, you know, because we've dealt with I tell officers all the time, listen, in this career you're going to go through peaks and valleys. You know, you're going to have great moments and then not so great moments, and there's going to be a lot of support and then maybe not so much support, and I think it's cyclical, and I think that, you know, again, we'll recover eventually.
Sure. Talking to Lieutenant Jim Perez of the Fairfield Police Department. Now, another thing that I'm sure you're noticing, Lieutenant, most beaches this past weekend reached capacity because there's still a cap on parking and so on and so forth. What is Fairfield seeing when it comes to beaches and people social distancing?
We're being overwhelmed. Yesterday is a perfect example. It was so crowded.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it's difficult to have social distancing rules. to keep them, especially in a beach environment. I'm not sure. There was a lot of social distancing that went on and the beach yesterday. But one thing that concerns me is that we have an abundance of cars that are illegally parking. And, you know, we have this broken windows theory in policing, and this has been forever. And the broken windows theory is that, you know, if they did an experiment, social engineers did an experiment years ago where they took a building, they refabbed it, you know, they fixed it up.
Yeah.
And then someone broke a window on it. The social engineers left it alone, and they found that when they leave it alone, it gets worse and worse as time goes on. Before you know it, people were living illegally in this building. So they redid it again. They kicked everybody out. They fixed it up again. And the minute that a window broke, they went ahead and they fixed that window. And they discovered that once you fix that window, once the criminal elements or people who just disregard the laws see that the laws are being enforced, then they don't repeat the behavior. Now, here's the problem. At the beaches, we have a lot of areas that are permit parking only. And unfortunately, you have beachgoers who are willing to pay whatever fine that is just to have a space so they can go to the beach. And these are usually out of towners. They're not really, you know, people from the or not even out of towners, like from not even from the region.
Right.
They're coming from as far as New York. They're coming from upstate Connecticut. And it's it does create a burden. First of all, what ends up happening is if you're willing to illegally park and break that law, you're probably, like the broken windows theory, mm-hmm. you're probably willing to commit other sort of minor things, such as, you know, littering. And this drains on the resources of the local towns. And so this is what we're facing now. And fortunately, the fines will be going up for that. But unfortunately, I think people will still pay it. And the thing that bothers me is not the fact that they'll pay the fine, but what bothers me is the fact they're willing to break the law in a sense,
sure.
right?
Yeah.
By not following it. And then where does it end? So I think we have, you know, a little bit of an issue for the next month or so. And then once beach season, you know, ends, I think it'll go back to normal. But I believe that probably every town in the area is being inundated with people that just want to get out. And I get it. You know what I mean? They just want to get out. But
right.
Unfortunately,
but you got to follow the rules. Sorry.
Follow the rules. And that's the biggest problem. And,
yeah.
You know, so, and, you know, I don't know. It's weird. So people feel like they can break the rules. And then the way they feel about police at times is kind of like almost like a double, you know,
double-edged sword.
Sure. Yeah,
sure.
You can't really win. But we're trying to, we're doing the best we can.
We're chipping along. We're chipping
right
along slowly.
That's it.
Lieutenant Perez.
God, I know.
Well, I love being
it's
able to
rough.
Check in with you. Thank you for this insight this morning,
sure.
And we'll talk again soon.
All right. You're welcome. Have a great week.
All right. You too.